Hello, welcome everyone to New Books in African Studies. I am Esperanza Brizuela Garcia, one of the hosts of this channel. Today we'll be talking to Dr. Jennifer Hart about her 2016 book, Ghana on the Go, African Mobility in the Age of Modern Transportation, published by Indiana University Press. Dr. Hart is an associate professor at the History Department at Wayne State University. Her research interests focus on African and urban history, and she specifically works on the city of Accra in Ghana. Dr. Hart, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
I wonder if we could start the interview by you telling us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I'm originally from rural Western Kentucky, a place near Calvert City, which most people have never heard of or been to. And I made my way kind of out of there to Denison University in Ohio, in central Ohio. And I worked with an extraordinary group of Africanists, interdisciplinary kind of cohort of Africanists there, who happened to be faculty at the time, including Pamela Scully and Sita Ranshaw Nelson and Joanna Grabsky and Susan Diddick and Kent Maynard and James Pletcher. And I was an international studies major and started kind of pursuing African history there out of an interest in trying to understand a bit more about where my friends come from. I had several friends from Zimbabwe, and I was really ashamed that I didn't know anything about them or where I didn't know anything about Zimbabwe. I didn't know, I'd never heard of it before. I didn't know where it came from or where it was. I had no idea kind of the history and kind of culture of this place. So I started doing research from there. And I was very interested in development and rigorous kind of interdisciplinarity. And so I was an international studies and philosophy double major and very interested in issues of identity and development and Christianity and other sorts of related issues. And I did a study abroad program when I was at Denison, going to Ghana for a semester, where I was pretty much directly enrolled in the University of Ghana and did some research there as an undergraduate, and then went back and wrote an honors thesis about it. I went on to Indiana University for graduate school, where I got my master's degree, my PhD, working with John Hansen and Gracia Clark, among many others, and was very grateful for the opportunity to once again kind of be in an interdisciplinary environment and have continue to pursue my interest in anthropology and art history and political science while also kind of being grounded or anchored in one discipline in history. And so African studies gave me the ability, that kind of situation being both in the history department and in African studies, gave me the ability to kind of think about what it means to be simultaneously within a discipline and engaged in interdisciplinary work. And now I worked for a year at Goshen College while I was finishing my PhD and got to know very well Jan Shetler, who is there, who I was replacing when she was on sabbatical, and many of her lovely colleagues. And that was such a wonderful place. And I'm now at Wayne State University in Detroit, where I teach courses in African history and history communication and digital history and world history, and work quite closely with colleagues at Michigan State University and the University of Michigan.
And how did you specifically come to write Africa on the Go?
Ghana on the Go came in part out of that first study abroad experience. I think, when I arrived in Ghana, I was very interested in what I ended up calling the kind of public culture of religion that was everywhere, and it was particularly on very present in the signs that were on shops and on the backs of these public transportation vehicles called trotros, but also taxis and other things, sometimes private cars. And there's other elements of the public culture of religion that I was also interested in, the kind of very loud and vibrant gospel music being played all the time, and the ways in which people greeted each other, which often at that time had to do with your religious affiliation. the kind of omnipresence of churches and mosques in people's daily lives. And so I went to graduate school interested very much in this relationship between kind of this public culture of religion and practices like market trading and driving, which as some people or a lot of people often cast as part of the informal economy. So I went to do pre-dissertation research in 2007 when I was in graduate school and went to Ghana trying to research this project. In particular, I wanted to do a history of the suburb of Medina in Accra, and to talk about the role of the public culture of religion in Medina and the kind of role of religion in the development of the town, and which was explicitly founded by a Muslim cleric or scholar of some sort, and but quickly has become associated with not only a large Muslim population, but also a very large Pentecostal-like Christian population. And so I went there trying to do research on that. And I started doing interviews. And I was particularly interested in interviewing people who own shops and the women who own the shops with the very vibrant signs and people who drove vehicles, chochos and taxis that had these signs. And when I got there, I found that I had, because of a person who was helping me with my research, Samuel Ntuwusu, who's a very wonderful scholar who works at the University of Ghana and various universities in the Netherlands. And he was he had close connections because of his own research to drivers in Medina. And so I found a very easy connection to drivers and had very interesting conversations with them. Most of them young and not really having a strong sense of the way that this public culture of religion changed over time. But I did find it very difficult to talk to the female shop owners in that short of a time. And so it became very difficult and I started to get very anxious about whether it was going to be possible to do this research. There was also not a lot in the archives that I could trace historically. So it still is a very interesting anthropological project. And some people are doing that work now, actually, out of the Netherlands. But it wasn't something I felt I could do as a historian at that particular time. But I did, in the process of trying to work out whether that research project was possible, I did interview a man, an older gentleman, who drove a shared taxi at Atomic Junction in just outside of Medina. And he had the most extraordinary life. And I talk about this in the introduction to the book, actually, that you know, his name was Al-Haji, and he had begun driving quite early. He'd worked for the Public Works Department, and he, through the Public Works Department, began playing football. His prowess as a football player got him significant attention, and he was able to play for the Black Stars, Ghana's national team, in the year that they won the Africa Cup of Nations, which was pretty extraordinary. Apparently, he got injured just before the match, and so didn't himself play in the match, but his brother did, and he was part of the team. And he also did other extraordinary things. He was one of the ceremonial drivers at just after independence, when people from all over the continent, leaders from all over the continent, came and gathered in Accra for the All Africa Peoples Conference, and Kwame Nkrumah, his government identified drivers all over the city and asked them, gave them special uniforms and fancy cars, and asked them to drive these people from the airport to the conference center just outside Accra, and so he was involved in those sorts of things, and it struck me as extraordinary that this man who you know, worked in a field that many today really deride as criminal and as kind of irrelevant, but just not something of very high prestige or something very important to history, he was at the center of so many extraordinary events, and it was his work as a driver that got him there. And so his story made it suggested to me that there was a very interesting history there. It also made it clear that that history wasn't going to be linear in the way that some historical narratives progress. And as I say in the introduction as well, that his life was a mobile one, and mobile lives don't normally go in kind of straight lines. They're traveling down roads, but they take lots of turns, right? And there's lots of stops and starts, and lots of backtracking, and lots of going around the same routes over and over again. So that kind of metaphor of the work of driving seemed to me to be, or ultimately proved itself to be very apt in describing the ways that this this history unfolded for me in the process of research. But I returned to Ghana I returned to Indiana and wrote grant applications, hoping that this work was going to pan out. It's something that I decided toward the end of my pre-dissertation time. So I'm so grateful that I'm so grateful for all the people that helped me in that process. All the people who talked to me in Ghana, who helped that, because it was a bit of a leap.
Yeah, and well, I mean, and as I started reading the book, I was, it's almost like I was sharing your anxiety as I started reading the introduction. I was kind of sharing into that anxiety because I have to confess, I was just not aware of, first of all, of the literature that exists in terms of the notion of mobility and automobility from the point of view of like just the history of technology. So you had to sort of, first of all, leap into that and then sort of kind of find ways in which that literature might allow you to tell these other stories. So I guess, and the other part of that, I had never thought about how broad and how far-reaching automobiles reach into people's lives, you know, and that's probably dumb because I guess it's one of those things that you take for granted and you just don't realize how much it shapes what you do and who you are and how you see yourself. So as I was reading your introduction, I was honestly quite impressed at just how you present us with this very expansive literature first, and then this very expansive way of experiencing the world. And then you slowly through the book start to sort of find ways of telling this story. So I was wondering if you can, you know, I'm sure it wasn't easy. you make it look very easy in the book, but how did you work your way into that particular structure and methodology? Because it is really like you had so much stuff that you could have said, and you end up narrowing things down in a way that you come up with a very cohesive history.
Yeah, I think in some ways I came away from the research being very clear. So before this book was published, it's the first, to our knowledge, of its kind in terms of being a kind of comprehensive monograph that actually looks at the history of African motor transportation, which is pretty extraordinary, actually, because it is something that literally everybody talks about, right? Anybody who's gone to the continent, everybody has a story, right? Everybody collects the slogans that are on the back of vehicles, which is something that is widely shared, not only on the continent, but elsewhere in the world. And, you know, everybody has transport stories. Everybody knows drivers, and so it was really extraordinary to me that there was very little written. There's a few things written about the slogans on the backs of lorries, but there's not much else, and there certainly wasn't anything written historically, and that was starting to change a little bit. There is an edited collection called The Speed of Change that Jan-Bart Gevald had put out around the time that I was writing. And there were a few graduate students, particularly in anthropology, There were a few also working with Jan Barton History as part of a research project in the Netherlands on the history of the internal combustion engine. And several of them working in Ghana, including Samuel Ntuosu. And Jan Bart himself had written a bit about this as well, not in Ghana, but in Zambia and in Namibia. But it was very shocking to me. And so I felt myself a little bit adrift in terms of Africanist literature. I didn't feel like there was an obvious set of scholarship that could inform what I was talking about. The other challenge was that I was very committed to telling this story through the course of the 20th century. I thought it was very important. To talk about the way that this technology and the lives of people who use that technology and create meaning with it changed over the course of the 20th century, including the periods in the history of Ghana that tend to be ignored. In part because of the 30 years or so of military dictatorship, where not a lot found its way into the archives, and so I was kind of adrift in two ways then, I suppose, at least in parts of the book where there weren't a lot of archives available, and there wasn't a lot of obvious secondary literature available, so I found myself thinking very carefully about what Driver said. And in some ways that was a bit of a blessing, not having this kind of scholarly conversation, this obvious scholarly conversation to connect to that was already kind of predetermined. I was forced to try to think about what the chronology or what the narrative would be from the perspective of people who experienced it. And so I took very seriously the kind of moments of change or shift that the Drivers identified. I really tried to think carefully about silences where they existed. So for example, in the period of military dictatorship, where I think I certainly went in assuming that there would be significant narratives of kind of resilience and resistance in the way that we see with market women in Ghana, that Gracia Clark, for example, studies and describes very in great detail and with great eloquence, but Drivers didn't have that, and so they were like, yeah, it was fine, we kept working, you know. and so sometimes I would try to ask them leading questions to try to force what I thought was a conventional chronological narrative based on the extent secondary literature, and they didn't respond to that at all, and so I was forced in those situations to really take seriously what they were saying and to interrogate some of my fundamental assumptions about this economic sector, about the kind of role of Drivers within the larger economy of Ghana, and whether or to what degree the categories of formal and informal, which have been kind of the dominant ways that we've talked about African economy for the last at least 30 years or so, whether those were relevant and to Driver's work, and how kind of driving fit into the kind of larger history of Ghana and of the continent, but also of global history. And I think I was particularly well aware of the significance of automobility, and felt particularly sitting in Detroit, the motor city, that there was this kind of dominant narrative about what the motor vehicle means and what it looks like and how it changed the world, that didn't always fit or didn't include or leave room for stories like the Drivers that I interviewed and the stories that I saw in the archives. And so I think, you know, it was. In most cases, it was the kind of lack of an obvious path that pushed me to try to find different ways to see things, in an effort to kind of make sense of what I was seeing, and it often led me to challenge a lot of perceived wisdom or kind of received narratives about these really common things. Because you're very right that I think all of us, myself included, often take for granted motor vehicles, especially in the United States. And there is an assumption that it means a certain thing. And I mean, it's attached in this country to the idea of autonomy and freedom, you know, the open road, and there's all this culture, material culture attached to it, and infrastructural or architectural kind of built environment attached to it. It literally changed our landscapes, right? It created suburbs and all these sorts of things. And so that kind of story, and particularly the individual, the private car, the family car, is very dominant. It's the way that we think about what it means to be automobile, what we think that these vehicles bring with them. And it was very interesting and provocative to me to think about the experiences of these drivers over the course of the 20th century, and the ways in which they didn't fit that narrative, and what that might tell us about the history of technology and the history of mobility in Africa.
I also was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more, how did this dual meaning that you give to the notion of on the go came to you? You know, this you talk about on the go just in terms of like the physical mobility, but also like a more general sense of progress or possibility that sort of like has underlined the history of automotive technology in Ghana. So how did that come to you?
That's also something that came from drivers, and they were very clear to me that their embrace of this technology was all about what it provided for them. And so they used a couple of phrases over and over and over again, in some ways to my frustration, that that seemed to be very closely associated with their kind of occupational practice. And so the first was, I would ask them, you know, why did you become a driver? And they would say, it's in my heart. And I kept saying, what does that mean? What does that mean? They're like, it's in my heart. This idea that it was a calling, that there's something, there was something in them that I think in some ways a restlessness, a desire to see the world, a desire to move, that was really important in their lives, and they felt compelled when they saw the vehicle. They would talk about how they felt called to the vehicle in certain ways. They would also talk a lot about how they went in the process of being a driver, through their experiences of being a driver, their eyes were opened. They'd say, "Menibuye," my eyes were opened. And this idea, Gracia Clark actually makes an argument about Enibuye being, and kind of eye-opening, being a metaphor or a way in a con culture to talk about modernization or modernity. This idea that it's a fundamental change, that you see things in new ways. And I think for many drivers, particularly in the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, they really felt that their occupation was attached to a new way of being in Ghana. And they were very proud of that. They were very proud that they facilitated not only their own kind of worldliness and eye-opening, but that of others. And they were part of a larger conversation that really tried to imagine what the future of Ghana would look like, and to create systems and infrastructures on in African terms, from the perspective of Ghanaians, that really tried to imagine a future Ghana. And even in the context of colonialism, right, which is often not the story that we get. So it really does come from them. And I think that that remains true in the later periods after the 1960s, and particularly after the coup that overthrew Kwame Nkrumah. I think the public conversation about Ghana being on the go has declined a bit, and for various reasons. But I don't think that it ceases to be true. I think that it's just the public conversation about that has changed. And as a result, kind of driver's self-awareness kind of gradually changes over the second half of the 20th century. But it's shifting back again, I think, a little bit. So there might be yet more thought about that. But Ghana, it has long been this this place of great aspiration. I think that there's some of that. There's a very entrepreneurial spirit in Ghana that's always thinking about kind of the future and thinking about how to create things, which I think is a very future oriented mode. But there's also, especially through Kwame Nkrumah and a lot of the nationalist movements, this notion of Ghana as a leader on the continent, a place where political futures are imagined and brought into being. And so I think that's really powerful, and that's something that drivers felt closely associated with.
Yes, and I also think, I mean, in your first chapter, I particularly found very interesting how it seems to be both a history, like you said, of innovation, but also of continuity of this sort of entrepreneurial culture, entrepreneurial mobility, I think you call it. Could you tell us a little bit more about that? You know, how you sort of find, so how to juxtapose these two stories of innovation and continuity?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think this is actually one of the more important things that African histories bring to the history of technology. And the history and economic history is this notion that innovation doesn't have to look like the West, and it doesn't have to be completely new. And of course, in the Western context, innovation wasn't ever something that was completely new. You always are rooted in your current context, even as you're thinking about the future and thinking about change. That's kind of a truism of history, right? We study continuity and change. But I think in Ghana, that's a particularly true thing. And I think it's the fact that drivers and the other vehicle owners and traders and farmers, seized on this new technology and to innovate on existing practices, to try to protect and reinforce their networks and to elevate them in certain ways. I think that's really powerful, and I think it's a great challenge to the histories of the continent more broadly, the histories of empire and imperialism and resistance and all of these kind of big tropes of African history, I think, and some of the broader narratives of world history. That Africans, as Clapperton Mavunga argues, weren't mere adopters of foreign technology, but they were creating things themselves, right? They were creating technologies, and they were creating technological systems and technological meaning through innovation that was rooted in African experiences. That it doesn't have to be a kind of technology that is rooted in the kind of cultural context, sociocultural context of the West. And I think this is, I was just talking to and writing about Black Panther today. And I think that this is something that comes very strongly out of that film. And so it resonates quite broadly. This idea that, it's there are other kind of technological futures that we can imagine that don't have to look like the West. There's different kinds of technological chronologies and narratives that exist that have different kinds of roots. And I think that the story of drivers in this period is a really powerful example of that.
And it's interesting also because, in a way, again, the story of automobiles as a technology, in a way, I was thinking about this as I was reading, is similar in that sense, like you said, with other technologies. I mean, for instance, we keep talking sometimes about language as something, like you said, that was adopted or imposed or, but in many ways, European languages were were technologies that were adopted for the purposes of for African purposes, and in that sense, they were Africanized too. So, like you said, it gives you this this sense of understanding technological introductions or adoptions, not just in terms of impositions or outsiders, introduction of outside influences, but as something that was responding to very specific needs and offering very specific types of possibility. So I thought that was a very, like you said, a very powerful way of challenging how we study the introduction or technological history in Africa. But also, I was very, in that first chapter, I also thought that it was really interesting how it was a metaphor, if maybe not a metaphor, but it was, it came with that also history of how it was a response to this notion of technopolitics, you know, the notion that the colonial powers, the British, were trying to sort of defend the preeminence of the railroad as something that they could control, as opposed to these automobiles or mobile vehicles that that Africans could through which Africans could gain greater control of their own lives. So, can you speak a little bit more about that sort of conflict?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think that for the British and for colonial governments across the continent, I think that there was an assumption that industrial technology was this this awe-inspiring kind of what Brian Larkin calls the colonial sublime, this thing that would just kind of you know, induce awe and deference among African peoples. And in part that comes from Europe's own history, right? That if you've watched kind of anything, any kind of British drama set in the 19th century, you inevitably get a story about how people were scared to ride on the first train. And there's lots of historical accounts of that, of people fainting and other sorts of things. And the same with motor vehicles, right? And very, very, a lot of fear associated with the danger of motor vehicles. You see that in Downton Abbey, for example, right? It's the storyline there in the early 20th century. So, you know, Europeans had this awe attached to technology and had used technology for their own purposes, but had were certainly overconfident, right? And in the ways that, as part of a kind of larger hubris that comes with the civilizational mission that the British and others were pursuing, you know, really believed that their grasp, you know, if they had managed to grasp these things, to develop them and grasp them and tame them to be less dangerous, then that means that they were not only had a degree of technological superiority over other parts of the world, but that they should be able to use those technologies to control people and within their own populations and elsewhere. And so certainly in colonies, which were explicitly, I mean, you know, colonialism in Africa was an explicitly extractive enterprise. The British and the French were very clear about this. Regardless of the kind of rhetoric of civilization and any kind of altruism, it was clear at the end of the day that it was about trade and about capitalism and extraction to fuel the industrial economies of the West, which needed a constant supply of raw materials and growing markets to sell surplus. And so, you know, the technological infrastructure, particularly mobility infrastructure, transport infrastructure, was very important to that. That narrative. And so that, you know, there's this very famous map that I think everybody who teaches African history uses of the continent and its railway lines that go directly into the interior, right? And we often use this map to highlight very visibly and kind of undeniably that infrastructure in the colonial context was almost exclusively built for extractive purposes. And that was certainly true of railways in the Gold Coast. That railways were an effort to control the flow of goods that were necessary or very important for industrial production, and initially that was well, earlier than that, it was the slave trade. But by the time they were building railways in the early 20th century, it was palm oil and cocoa. And particularly by the 1930s and 1940s, it was cocoa. And it was particularly interesting in the Gold Coast, and I think is very different than a story in South Africa, for example, or Kenya even, because Africans controlled the land and were the primary or sole producers of cash crops, and so had significant economic authority or economic autonomy because of that, right? They had leverage, and had long controlled the interior trade, and there were very powerful trading kingdoms, including the Asante, but not only that were able to not only control the economic sector, but to back that control up with a very powerful military. And so there was this big effort at the beginning of the 20th century to try to break some of that, to be able to more directly control the flow of goods, and to cut off African authority or autonomy as much as possible. And so railways were built, particularly into cocoa growing regions, which often tended to produce palm oil as well. And the goal was to get Africans to sell directly to trade representatives at railway stations in the rural areas, in the production zones, and then to allow the railway to control the movement of that produce to the coast, where they could sell it then for a higher price and ship it abroad. And so the goal was to cut down the cost, right, and to undermine the power of African farmers and traders. What's great about this story is that Africans use this technology of the motor vehicle, which Europeans dismiss as something that they're not really interested in pursuing and they don't think is going to be useful, and really take it as their own and use it as a way to undermine the system, right? Using roads that were for some reason built directly beside the railways. In many cases, building their own roads, particularly in cocoa-growing regions, using their profits and investing them in these vehicles and in the infrastructure necessary to run them, as a way to get around this colonial control. And I think that's an incredibly powerful story about not so much resistance, I suppose. I mean, it's a form of resistance, but it's also more than that, right? I think Africans, African farmers and traders and drivers and other people were asserting a sort of control, a persistence, and control and autonomy in the colony that they in many cases used to try to argue for rights to further infrastructure and investment. And so really kind of making citizenship claims in really important ways that we don't often hear about.
Yeah, I mean, it brought to me really this notion of kind of like an ownership of this emerging society, state, and using this technology to claim ownership of it. And I thought it was, as I said, you know, it's kind of like an assertment of agency that oftentimes, if you just saw it, and I think you make this point in your introduction, if you just thought about the automobile as within the history of like just another commodity that is introduced in this new area, you would not necessarily see it that way, you know, as a means through which people asserted their own agency. But that was exactly what they did. And it's interesting as you continue in the next two chapters to talk about how this develops, you know, sort of that the contestation continues, although it sort of moves to other areas like public safety or who's entitled to become a driver and what is it exactly that comes out of being a driver. So how do you see those questions developing in this latter part of the colonial period?
Yeah, so the British kind of had to play catch up, right? They didn't see motor transportation as something that was interesting or viable, And I certainly didn't see it as something that Africans would control. The idea that Africans were drivers and controlled most of the motor transport sector was really unprecedented within the British Empire and across the continent. And people who would come, British colonial officials and others who would come to the continent, they would tell each other, oh, it's different here. Africans drive. You know, you won't see a European person driving. And that was something that wasn't possible elsewhere, at least at this early period. It becomes possible after independence, and you see the growth of these motor transport sectors after independence in many places. But in Ghana, it happens much earlier. The British colonial state finds itself kind of caught unawares and has to retroactively figure out how to control this industry, which has emerged outside of its control and without its systems of regulation. And so you see a lot of tensions over the 1930s, 1940s, and 1950s about what a proper driver looks like, right? And here you have different kinds of work cultures and technological cultures and cultures of expertise and skill and risk that come into conflict in really interesting ways that I think are very instructive for historians of Africa, historians of economy. And a lot of these debates continue to resonate today. So, for example, one of the most interesting to me that's a sort of theme that goes throughout the book, I think, is this notion of risk. And we often associate, we being people in the West or whatever, often associate risk as being an inherently bad thing. That risk is something you want to try to avoid, right? And you want to, if there are things that are inherently risky that you want to insure yourself against risk, right? There's all these sorts of ways that we try to calculate risk and avoid it. And the British certainly operated on that in that way. And I think a lot of the scholarship on African roads and African economies also comes from this, or is rooted in this assumption. But drivers did not see it that way. Drivers saw risk, the drivers I talked to certainly, saw risk as something that you managed, that your skill was determined not by your ability to avoid risk, but by your ability to manage risk. And so if you could manage risk and not suffer the ill consequences, so if you could engage in risky behavior and still keep control of your vehicle, that meant you were a real expert. You have very high levels of skill. And the ability to do that was something that you observed through training, through long systems of training as assistants or mates on vehicles, and with master drivers. And you learned to control yourself. You learned to block out the kind of what drivers sometimes refer to as the sort of nonsense of passengers, the arguments and the noise and the whatever, and to know your vehicle very well. And so they, you know, especially early drivers and especially drivers of mammy trucks that drove long distance, they were very involved in the in kind of knowing their vehicle. They were mechanics themselves. They knew how to repair things, and in many cases there were quite elaborate stories about how they would repair things on the road, putting banana skins on hoses and other sorts of things. But you know, we're incredibly proud of their ability to do this. And so you see over and over and over again in the colonial archives, these conversations between, you know, police officers and district administrators and other sorts of things, other sorts of people saying, you know, why do Africans continue to overload their vehicles? Why do they continue to drive too fast? Why do they, you know, why do they park on the roadsides? Why do they drive over rough roads? And what drivers told me was that those things weren't considered bad. It was only bad if you got an accident, right? And if you got in an accident, it meant you weren't a very good driver. And many of them, many of the older drivers were very proud to tell me that they'd never had an accident. And so this, I think this is something that continues today, right? We have all this kind of anxiety attached to precarity, and I've had very interesting conversations recently with Ghanaians who again frame the idea of risk or precarity in very different ways. They say risk is opportunity. not necessarily something inherently bad. And, you know, whether I agree with them or not, or whether I see that as a collective social good or not, is not really the point. But they certainly have a different way of thinking about it. And I think it structures the kind of economic decisions that they make in different sorts of ways.
Well, and they certainly saw saw a lot of that risk taking rewarded. You know, they did achieve, as you said. They achieve greater profit. They achieve many of them greater sense of respectability, et cetera, et cetera. So, in many ways, it was not a myth. You know, they reaped the benefits of taking some of those risks, but at the same time understood they were very political savvy. They obviously understood the advantages of seeking some forms of profits, becoming a more professional sort of group through their unions. That was also interesting that they, even though they understood that some of those behaviors would give them some benefits, they also saw the benefits of seeking some kind of more professional status.
Yeah, I think a lot of that, though, I talk a lot about the driver concerns about the conditions of possibility of their work. And when I talk to drivers about the government and the role of the government, they would frequently say that that government should, ensure the conditions of possibility for our work and lives, and otherwise should stay out of our way. So this notion that, in part that comes from a kind of colonial context where the government wasn't a social contract, right? It wasn't coming from the people. It was intended to limit African opportunity, and access. And so, I think for them, professionalization to some degree, I mean, they had systems of training that were about kind of passing on skill and developing expertise. But I think that the notion of professionalization in a formal sense and in terms of forming unions to negotiate with government was really about protecting the conditions of possibility of their work. And the British made it very clear that they would not negotiate. They would not engage in collective bargaining or any sort of negotiation, would not meet with representatives who were not registered as formal unions. And so British trade unionists went around the country and around the continent, really, trying to organize people into these trade unions. And drivers really took this on, but did it again on their own terms, right? So taking older traditions of driver training and systems of chieftaincy and other sorts of things and kind of bringing them together in a form of occupational association and professionalism that has a lot in common with unions, but also functions very differently from them.
So how does this all start to change in the post-colonial period? As you said, you know, there's a lot of there's going to be some elements of continuity, but there's also going to be a lot of change. So, which is what you trace in the letter chapters of the book. What are the main things that start to change and what are the main things that sort of remain?
Yeah, so a lot of the change that happens in the, especially between the 1960s and the 1980s, isn't something that happens immediately or that the drivers see is happening immediately. So it was kind of interesting to think about that. So as I mentioned before, you know, I would ask drivers kind of when did things get bad or you know, in the 1980s there was a shortage of petrol. Surely things had to be really hard then, or there were no spare parts. You know, what did you do? Were things difficult? And they were like, nah, we still made money. Right. And as good entrepreneurs, I think that, you know, the most successful drivers, the ones that were well established and really knew their vehicle and knew their work, adjusted, right. They adjusted to the conditions and they, in many cases, raised their fares. Of course, when you're providing a public service for a private profit, and everybody is in a condition of, or is kind of living through a context of great economic instability and stress. In the case of the 1980s, people literally starving, and in some cases, kind of infamously wearing Rawlings necklaces. You could see the collarbones of their, you could see their collarbones during this period because there was so little food because of a drought. And And so, you know, in those situations, when you continue to profit, and in many cases profit quite significantly, while others are suffering, you kind of are in a very vulnerable position. And indeed, drivers quickly become like market women, who are also in a very similar situation, become scapegoats and in some cases scapegoats on the part of the government who were unwilling or unable to kind of address or halt this kind of economic decline over the course of about 30 years. But also increasingly criticized by the public who felt that drivers and market women were kind of unfairly profiting from their struggle and their suffering. And so the kind of goodwill that had existed between the public and drivers for a very long time really starts to dissipate. The conversation about drivers is no longer about them being worldly and cosmopolitan and desirable mates, but becomes about them being kind of criminal and dirty and uneducated and other sorts of things. And what's interesting is that driver practice during this period doesn't actually change very much. That it's the public conversation in the broader economic context that changes, and drivers, in not seeing that, find themselves caught on the kind of wrong side of that conversation. And in many ways, there might have been nothing they could do. I mean, they were entrepreneurs; they were trying to make money. It's not an altruistic enterprise, but they certainly do find their fortune significantly. Significantly altered, and older drivers in particular would talk about that with great sadness. In the beginning in 1983, with the development or the embrace of structural adjustment and new forms of new models of development, you do see a reinvestment in motor transportation infrastructure more broadly, funded by World Bank and IMF loans, and drivers in some ways recovered their position, their kind of strategic position in relation to the government, because structural adjustment, of course, encourages decentralization. And so the idea that that government would not control fares and would not control infrastructure systems and transport systems like chotros or mammy trucks, for example, meant that the unions became much more powerful and much more important in this period. But it also means that drivers, the kind of broader conditions of structural adjustment, which don't ultimately end up producing the kinds of broad-based economic growth that was promised, means that more and more and more people enter the sector. There's a flood of vehicles into the country, and vehicles get more expensive, even at the same time that they're more widely available. And so there's a lot that kind of undermines drivers' work at the same time. So it's certainly a very complex situation, a complex set of processes that they're negotiating, which they can't often see, right? They don't always have access to the broader kinds of policy conversations, and so they're in many ways kind of responding to things as they come.
Yeah, and it seems like to a large extent, like you said, it is difficult to think of anyone, even at a policy level, who would be able to foresee just how large, how just even the sheer number of vehicles in the road would increase. I mean, the first time I went to Ghana, between the first and the second time I went to Ghana, there was probably like 8 years, and I just couldn't believe how much traffic, there was. I mean,
yeah, same.
In just a very brief amount of time. So that alone sort of gives you a sense of how rapid the change was and how it's possible that nobody literally saw it coming. I think I've taken quite a bit of your time by now. Could you tell us a little bit, what are you working on right now?
Sure. I'm following up some of these themes in slightly different ways, focusing in particular on the history of Accra. And so right now I'm actually in the midst of working on some things, contextualizing or thinking about the kind of policy implications of bus rapid transit, and imagining or thinking about chochos as indigenous technological systems that maybe can be viable alternatives or viable systems to deal with urban crisis with a little investment and careful thought. So really taking these concerns and questions that I pursued historically in the book into the present and thinking about their policy implications today. And I'm also beginning work, or have been working for the last couple of years, I suppose, on a history of what we call DIY urbanism in Accra. And so looking at the development of the city over the 20th century through the lens of kind of local development and grassroots development, and looking at the kinds of solutions and ideas about kind of space and mobility and urbanity that Accra residents have come up with on their own, and that have, in many cases, really stood the test of time or defined the city in really important ways. As a way to kind of counter the very dominant story about Accra as a planned city or a failed city or a city of slums or something else, but instead to say that that these local practices actually mean something, and perhaps the failures of the city or the ways in which the city is a difficult place to live might have something to do with our inability to see, to understand, and to meet the needs of people who live there.
Wow, that sounds great. Are you finding, are you pursuing this similarly to the previous project through private stories, try to match those questions with archival searches?
In many cases, yeah. A lot of the things that that I am interested in now don't really show up in archives very much. Not unlike actually the history of driving. A friend of mine, Josh Grice, frequently talks about how when you're doing the history of things that are considered part of the informal sector, those tend not to appear in the archives, right? That the archives are by nature documenting the formal sector. And when they do talk about what government officials consider the informal, they're often doing so in a derogatory way, right? So there's limits to the archives. So yeah, it relies very heavily on interviews and material culture and popular culture that makes it a really exciting project.
Yeah, it does sound. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast today. I really enjoyed it, and I hope you did too. And we really look forward. We really look forward to your next project. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Take care.